Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome to another episode of Verdict Academy, where we bring you the best trial lawyers in the country to share their top three trial tips. I'm Kevin Morrison, and this episode's guest is Mike Kelly, a partner at WalkUp in San Francisco. Mike is a giant in the profession, and his accomplishments and well-deserved accolades are too numerous to mention in this 30-minute podcast. A small sampling of his extraordinary results include a $23 million verdict in a birth injury case against a local doctor in a small town in rural Minnesota, and an $8.3 million verdict in L.A. for the pain caused by the defective design of a metal hip implant against Dupuy. That verdict helped facilitate a $2.5 billion national settlement for all victims of this dangerous design. Mike is a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, the International Academy, the American College, and the International Society of Barristers, where he served as president, and BODA, where he served as San Francisco chapter president and was awarded Calabota's Trial Lawyer of the Year. Mike is a San Francisco native, graduated from St. Mary's College in Moraga, where he met his wife, Trish. He then went to UC Law San Francisco, aka Hastings. While Mike was in law school, the couple had their first two kids, and he juggled jobs, diaper changing, and law school classes, thereby perfecting the art of multitasking. After graduating law school, he worked at a small firm doing some criminal defense, quickly getting trial experience. He then joined the WalkUp firm, where he was mentored by some of our local legends like Dan Kelly, George Shelby, and Ralph Bastian. And now Mike returns the favor by mentoring trial attorneys across the country and is active in teaching at NIDA and other organizations. Mike Kelly, welcome to Verdict Academy.
Thanks, Kevin. That's the nicest thing anybody has said about me, and at least the last hour, but probably the last year, so I appreciate it.
Thanks for being a guest. Before we get into the three top, you know, the format of the show is asking the best trial attorneys in the country, and you're certainly among those. Their best or top trial tips to younger, less experienced attorneys. But before we get there, I just want to ask you a question. Did you always know that you wanted to be a courtroom lawyer?
I think probably not. You know, I went to undergraduate school at that time, mostly not to go to Vietnam. And while my family didn't know lawyers, didn't have lawyers, although my father occasionally got himself in a jam, I think that's something that kind of dawned on me while protests were ongoing against the Vietnam War. And I think I probably became a little more aware of the power of lawyers, particularly with respect to at that time. So I think that's what got me interested. And certainly I had no idea that people even went to court over injuries.
I know you're a fan of Senator Robert Kennedy and his campaign. When you got to law school, were you involved in trial advocacy, or was it until your first job when you actually got into a courtroom to try a case where you said, you know what, this is for me?
I don't think at the, you know, when I was in law school that we had a trial advocacy program. I'm pretty confident we did not. And yes, I mean, the first time I was in a courtroom, I was the lawyer representing somebody. I actually can see that in my head and can remember how anxious I was because it was in a criminal case where the defendant had been in court far more times than I had and actually knew his constitutional rights far better than I did.
Did he give you some tips?
No, but it caused me to do unbelievable amounts of homework so that I didn't get caught flat-footed in terms of protecting his rights.
And so when you got your first taste of trial, was that all it took? You got the bug and you can't shake it?
I recognize that now as I talk about it, but I think I recognized at that moment, you know, this was the ground floor of participatory democracy. And you could make a difference. You could make a change. And look, I went to 16 years of Catholic school, so nothing else had drummed into you that you needed to be able to make other people's lives better. That was why you're here.
You've certainly done that in your career. You continue to do that. So let's get right into it. Your three top tips for trial lawyers. We've got connecting many openings and voir dire. We've got expert cross-exam. And we've got damages, metaphors, and closing. So let's start with the start of trial, connecting many openings and voir dire. Talk to us about that, Mike.
It's a new recent development, right, in California, the notion of the mini opening. And as you mentioned, I've been blessed to do a fair amount of mentoring, teaching, demonstrations, trial ad teaching. And historically, I have always been a believer that opening statement was kind of a disrespected stepchild of the trial process. When I was a young lawyer, you know, the fear you had about opening statement was that you wouldn't say the right things and you would get non-suited. The practice was always motivated, at least at some level, by fear of screwing up. But, you know, over time, as I read more books, as I got to watch good lawyers, it became readily apparent to me that openings were critically important. And I did a lot of work teaching on the whole notion of you can't argue an opening, you can only recite the facts, which sounded like a caution that basically made everyone eunuchs. But the truth of the matter was, once you figured out how to tell a story with only facts, no adjectives, no adverbs, no hyperbole, and you structured the facts in a way that really told your story, you could see the lawyer on the other side, the defense lawyer, wanting to jump out of her or his chair and object, but they couldn't figure out how. Gotten that to a place where we were good at it. You know, the legislature then gives us here in California the opportunity to do these mini openings, which I think they're better understood, but I think they're misunderstood to the extent that what are they for? Because they're not for doing a shorter version, you know, like a TV show gives you the first 60 seconds and you watch the next 29 minutes anyway. What is that about? For me, the mini openings are about let's get everything out there that's bad, because it's a shoehorn into voir dire. There's none of this objections, oh, counsel is pre-trying the case or arguing the case. And so for me, the mini opening and voir dire kind of marriage or handshake is, and predominantly I'll just talk about damages. It's a place where I think everyone now recognizes how important anchoring is. Defendants like to make motions to prevent anchoring. Their favorite is to make a motion in limine to prevent somebody from talking about the specific number they want. And my view on that is to be prepared for it and to use the mini opening and say what some people historically have been afraid to say in opening, what's the number you're coming for? And whether you want to say, you know, and at the end of this case, we will ask you for a verdict of $50 million or $20 to $40 million or $5 million, just to get the number out there so that we're not in this place in voir dire, that's not helpful. And I don't think it's helpful to say, well, you know, is there anything about making a substantial award that you have difficulty with, or the facts in this case compel a substantial award? You know, it's like talking in code and conclusions. Lawyers love conclusions because it somehow makes you think or makes them think we have covered the topic. But, you know, conclusions are just overwhelmingly unpersuasive. And so I think the mini openings are a gift. They're guaranteed by statute. I think there are still judges who are hesitant and reticent to do it. I think everybody's trial notebook needs to have in it the code section that authorizes it. A month and a half ago, I was picking a jury in Napa. And we went through these motions, and the judge, who was a former public defender, hadn't tried a civil case, said, okay, well, I see the statute, yes, you know, and denied the defense motion to preclude discussion of specific numbers, but then kind of almost lost his mind when in mini opening, and my colleague, my partner, who I tried the case with, gave the mini opening and gave a number, and once we got into voir dire, the judge was beside himself that this was all the jurors wanted to talk about. You know, I think $20 million is too much in this case. And then wanted to go back and talk about, let's talk about substantial numbers. So that point, I think you only need to say it once. I think anchoring is real. And then, you know, there were other issues in the mini opening in this particular case that had to do with, it was a wrongful death case where my clients were visitors and tourists against a local defendant. The defendant was very well known and liked. And then that was just about getting those things in as, for me, the pathway to voir dire. And so I think for folks who have not done one, have not used one, we shouldn't be confused that, you know, again, I've been doing this for so long. I've read every practice book that tells you everything to be worried about and afraid of, which changes about every 5 years. But for years, you know, well, I'm afraid to get into bad stuff because maybe I'm, you know, putting the thoughts of bad things in the jurors' minds. I think we figured out that's bunk. We're much better off getting the stuff out on the table.
It surprises me how often judges don't seem to understand the word shall when you cite the statute. But I do know from some stories that some judges, despite the shall, don't let you, which is assuming you get one, the judge follows the law. Then is your goal to, one, make sure the prospective panel has all the bad facts. They're going to come in so you can talk about those in jury selection and get your number out there, the number you're going to ask for. Are those essentially your goals?
If you look at it from that perspective, you have just driven right around or right past all of the objections that we would often get about prejudging the case or specific evidence. They're there. You know, you made your open. This is kind of, and if you think of it at the next level, it's like, this is actually kind of cool. I made my opening statement. Now I'm going to voir dire you about did you like it or not. But it's simply the opening statement I made wasn't about persuading you. It was about finding out about you.
Now, there seem to be two philosophies on giving the number early. Philosophy A, which I am a strong proponent of, it sounds like you are too, get the number out there. So my view is the jury assumes that the lawyer asking for the money knows what the case is worth. This lawyer damn well better know what the case is worth, and I expect him to tell us. And then there's the view that, oh my gosh, something could go wrong at trial. Maybe you're getting too ambitious and the doctor takes a dive, your client, you know, screws the pooch and that sort of thing. So don't commit to anything. What is your view there, Mike?
I think that correctly does outline what we want to be worried about. And let's take the fear of scenario B. I'm a proponent of scenario A. But look, if I'm worried that at some point something is going to go wrong, that is going to cause me usually not to say, you know, I'm going to ask you for $20 million or $8 million or $4 million, but to give a range. The range is just as good. We're going to come back and say the value of this case is somewhere between $4 and $10 million. I mean, I don't like that as much, but that takes into account, it gives me both a high and a low. And interestingly, when I've done that, jurors only hear the high, but it protects you psychologically from the notion that, well, the wheels fall off this truck. I can still ask for $4 million just because of the nature of the injury or whatever it is. So there's no perfect template. There's no perfect roadmap, but part of what we're supposed to be able to do is figure out, okay, if we hit a pothole, how are we going to keep going? And I think that's kind of it.
Point two, cross-examination of experts. How critical is this and what's your philosophy here, Mike?
I mean, I didn't lose all my hair and look this old because I had one frightening experience that made me look old. If you cut my forearm, the tree rings will tell you that I have been here, not since the dinosaurs, but for a while. So I think I would think historically that tried or bought into or looked at every philosophy on cross-examining experts at trial. And at the end, I come down to what's the safest thing? And the safest thing, whether or not you're using AI or Google or something else, is generally to live in a place where the opposing expert, two things. First, that it's not part of your job, except in the really exceptional case where you have a frequent flyer who is obvious to everyone in the room is a liar. But that is so rare that trying to cross-examine most experts on the substance of their expertise, you can't learn overnight on Google how to become a neurosurgeon, or for that matter, a mechanical engineer, or anybody who has spent 10, 15, 20, or 30 years of their life in some discipline. And so for me, when I'm working with young lawyers, I like to think about what it's a package. You can always start nice and finish mean. You can never start mean and finish nice, although I have seen it and confessed 30 years ago I have attempted it, where you come out of your seat far too hot. And there's a couple problems with that. One is the jurors, you had this case for 2 years. You are not fond of defense counsel. You are not fond of their failure to have integrity or be honest. You don't like their experts. But the jurors have only been in the case for 4.5 hours in the courtroom and can't figure out why Mr. Kelly lost his mind and turned into the most angry person in the world. So we got to figure out how to do that. And so for me, it's a package of two things. One is, to the extent possible, I like to cross-examine experts first about getting agreements, usually about my expert, about their qualifications, about their licensure, about their methodology. Do they at least do the right thing? Is their math at least accurate? Have they read the right books? Is the diploma from Dartmouth or the University of California or the University of Phoenix a decent degree? And then for me, you know, I like to see if there's some way that the cross-examination in a place where it's safe is all of the things they haven't done or haven't considered, because those are objectively verifiable facts you can argue. I like to tell people that cross-examination is like standing on a small island in the Pacific, surrounded by sharks. You can get in the water about to your ankle before you're close enough for one of the sharks to eat your toes. So you could get a little bit wet, but you don't want to be waist deep in this place where you're never getting out. And so for me, typically trying to do crosses on things not considered, things not looked at, things not done. In some ways, it's a curse of expert depositions. The problem with expert depositions, at least in California, is nobody's quite sure. Are they trying to settle the case or try the case? Because if you really knew, you would do different depos. But I'm mostly interested in trial that I have a list of things that without an adjective, without an adverb, I can ask 20 questions in a row where the answer is yes. They are not mean. They are not argumentative. And I call that the cross-examination of knots, K-N-O-T-S, but N-O-T-S, of all the things not done. If I'm really lucky, maybe I can get a little bit into substance. If I'm super lucky, maybe they've testified 180 degrees different one time before. It took a lot of hair turning white and falling out to figure out you're never going to make a jury, except in the really exceptional case, believe that somebody is a dishonest, evil person. I have done it, but they had to really leave a trail of breadcrumbs that could not be missed, or have made an assumption that the jurors decide before my tone or intonation influences it. This is baloney. I like to say that you cannot be more indignant than the least indignant juror. It's a curse for all of us. I mean, we're trying to do our best, but we talk too much to ourselves and then we believe ourselves and then we can't hear or see ourselves. That's kind of my take there. And I think the other part of it is one about duration. Have I done a cross-examination in trial for 2 hours of an opposing expert? Was any of that as recent as 10 years ago? No. I feel like there's a place to get the stuff you want to argue. There's a place where we have to trust the jurors to get the main point. Somebody once told me during a deposition that I could depose a witness for 2 hours on their driver's license. I thought that was both funny, but also disturbing because I got 60 or 90 minutes. Depends on the case, depends on complexity. Before I get up, I have to know what the last question and answer is, because I structure it so I know it can't possibly be a bad answer, even if it's not chronologically correct or temporally consistent with the story, and then hope that there's enough there to say at the end, we got the benefit of the jury instructions and know how to argue them. That's kind of my take on expert cross.
Two quick questions there. So much to talk about. But your philosophy then, when you take an expert deposition, my philosophy is, I just want name, rank, serial number. Give me all your opinions, every reason why, because I want to use good stuff for trial. Others say, I'm going to torture this guy and take his dep for 5 hours and make him settle the case. I just don't have that philosophy. But where are you? Does it depend on the case for you, or where are you on that?
I think it has something to do with kind of where you are in the arc of your career. I've now tried cases in states where there is no expert discovery. And, you know, 40 years on the day shift, that's not a problem because the defenses mostly are formulaic. And you know how to reconstruct any answer into a series of leading questions that you like.
These injuries were overtreated and she's probably complaining too much. Is that a possible defense? Yeah.
So the 5-hour deposition that tries to beat somebody up, to me, is an effort to get your case settled. If you have a really good insight, then I'm working on kind of on the first one. What, who, when, where, why? And then I will spend some time on not doing an aggressive cross-examination of knots, but tying up the loose ends on things I'm pretty sure the person didn't do. But ask them kind of not the, you never did X. By the way, were you able to do something, or at least be conversational so that those questions are restructured as part of a series of having not done the work? And I'd like the flexibility, because the 5-hour deposition is essentially you preparing the expert for their cross at trial. There's nothing left. They're going to read their dep 3 or 4 times. They're going to know where it's coming. But unless you're hugely skilled, which I am not, you have put a lot of stuff out there that you're never coming back. It depends how deep do we want to get into what's our strategy. Do I really want to confuse him by confusing myself by spending 3 hours on something I'm never going to touch? I could actually see doing that, but I think that is the exceptional case.
All right, third and final topic, damage metaphors, how you use those in closing.
We are supposed to be storytellers. There's two things in my head, and I've done some teaching on this, is how important visual information is, both actual photos, charts, diagrams, pictures, the photos, charge diagrams, and pictures that we create in people's head. And I'll just give you a simple one. I love the iceberg metaphor, which is the picture of an iceberg. And I have said, I have never seen an iceberg. The thing that's always been striking to me is that only about 1/10 of this iceberg is visible above the water. And what is below the water and unseen, and then I have a second picture of this massive underpinnings, is 90% of it. So you can't just look at what you see there and ignore what's below. And that really is the story of Jane Anderson, whose case you have heard this. What you see here in this courtroom is about 5% of what Jane endures. You don't see her at home. You don't see her unable to button a shirt. You don't see her unable to drive. You don't see the frustration in her head and in her mood. You don't see what happens to her when she can't remember something because of her brain injury, or she can't recall a phone number or a person's name. So just a tiny, I mean, there's plenty of them. I'm sitting in my office, and I didn't put this here on purpose, but I have these old binders. And the guy who founded my law firm was named Bruce Waka, was one of the original members of this group called the Inner Circle of Advocates, which at its founding in the 70s was a kind of a nationwide group of personal injury lawyers who were sharing stuff. And these are typewritten, onion skin. I have a collection of final arguments from the 70s and 80s that they shared with each other. They mailed back and forth. There was no email. There was no digital transmission. And it's fascinating that some of the same, I mean, the numbers are lower, but the same concepts, trying to create visual images. The Mo Levine has a great final argument. If folks can find Mo Levine stuff, he died in 1974. You think about Mo Levine won a slip and fall case in New York City. There, actually, the original book is really hard to find that has his arguments. And if you'd like to use it someday, Kevin, I'll get it to you. You know, here's a guy who convinces 12 jurors that a frozen driveway in a part of New York City is dangerous when the whole damn city with 8 million people is frozen, right? And, you know, how do you do that? You do that by creating pictures in people's minds. But he has a great argument on creating a picture in your head that somebody who the defense lawyer came in and said, you know, there's only 15% or 25% maximum disability. And his argument is, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to think that car, and one of the tires is shredded. You wouldn't say that that car is 25% disabled because that car is not usable. That car, like a person, of course, Mo Levine has a whole riff on the whole person, the whole man or woman. I think there is a place to find those things. Jim Perdue Sr., his original book, Who Will Speak for the Victim, has some really good examples. I think there's plenty of practice books. I'm not selling anybody's books. There are ways to look at them. And then I think the other image that is important to get in people's minds has to do with the analogies and whatnot, has to do with why we're here. I think most lawyers don't quite appreciate that the right to trial by jury is in the Bill of Rights. I mean, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of association, the right to bear arms. All of the framers of the Constitution, which hopefully will be intact whenever our current political trauma ends, demanded that the right to a civil jury trial be embedded, not just in the Constitution, but in the first 10 amendments, in the Bill of Rights. And so I like to talk about, when I'm talking about empowering jurors, you know, but most of them don't know that, partly because we quit teaching civics in the United States 15 years ago. But we also have in the California Constitution, some people at least have seen Hamilton, and some know about John Adams, and some know about Thomas Jefferson. They all have phenomenal quotes about the right to a jury trial. And so I think there are different places for different things where metaphor and analogy and word pictures can be used with jurors to get them invested. And there's a couple different ways to do it. And I'll just give you one I really like. Jim Perdue Sr., who wrote his book, his son, Jim Perdue Jr., is a really gifted lawyer in Houston. And he does a very nice job. He tries to find out in every courtroom that he goes to, was a big or important case that everybody knows tried here? So that I can say, you're sitting in a courtroom, and you could actually do this in San Francisco, except it wasn't a jury trial, you know, where there was a trial about the right of same-sex persons to be married. That took place in this building. And again, you know, you got to make sure that above all, that you're always entirely honest. So you can't use a jury metaphor there. But Perdue has, he tries to find a jury metaphor where he goes and says, you know, this is the courthouse where 12 people who just like you held the XYZ oil company responsible for whatever the most notorious event was that happened. And I think that in terms of metaphor and analogy and getting the jurors to see and feel, I'm in some place that's important. I'm doing some work that's important.
Incredible advice. As anticipated, the half an hour flew by. Mike, for any younger, less experienced trial attorneys out there trying to figure out how to get into a courtroom, or what advice would you give him or her out there?
I would not be bashful about approaching lawyers who they have met, whether in specialty bar associations or other places, and saying, I have this case that I'm going to try. I'm wondering if you will try it with me. Not, I want to refer it to you. And that's where I think you test the character and integrity of the people in your community, right? And, you know, I haven't done this. I want to try a case. I would love to have you try it with me. And I would put that at the top of my list. You know, there are also opportunities to volunteer your time on a bunch of different levels, mostly in metropolitan areas, either on cases usually that may involve tenants' rights or housing or with the DA. But if you find somebody or pick up your telephone, I think the telephone has become underutilized. Alexander Graham Bell would be quite distressed. I think the sound of somebody's voice and the fact that they picked up and dialed your number. So, I mean, I would put that at the top of my list. And it's going to tell you two things. It's going to tell you, first and foremost, what is the character of the person you're asking? And it'll tell you a little bit something about yourself. Because if you ultimately want to be good at it, you have to do it a lot. Two things about that I would say is we could read all the practice books in the world, but the greatest pianists don't sit around reading sheet music for 6 months and then say, I'm going to go play this goddamn song. They practice it. And the same thing, if you wanted somebody to fix a leaking faucet in your house, you would hope that they had done it 300 times before. Because, you know, if they came in with a t-shirt that said, this is actually my first rodeo, you hope that the integrity of the people you're with, and you'll learn something by doing it. And you cannot learn it by not doing it. And we see this. I mean, I see it. Lawyers, even of my vintage, if they haven't tried something in a year or 2 years, even though they know it inside out, you know, they're riddled with anxiety because they don't know it. But, you know, who the heck knows what's coming? So doing it's important. Doing it as much as possible is important. Certainly you and I both have heard more than we wanted ever to hear about the vanishing jury trial. It's not quite vanished, but doing nothing will assist in its ultimate invisibility.
Yeah, 100%. And hopefully this podcast is a tiny, tiny, tiny impet or a weapon to, or something that spurs people to try to get into courtrooms and try cases. And I really appreciate you being a guest on Verdict Academy, Mike. And more importantly, thanks for all the work you've done, not only for your clients, but for our community and frankly, for our country. I really appreciate your work for all of us.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.